peace.org for a listing of different actions. But I think it's just the beginning. It's a first step in organizing opposition to the wars, to the cuts, and demanding that money be spent for jobs and human needs right here, and not for endless war.
Okay, thanks a lot.
Sanctions either.
Thanks a lot. Sarah Flounders from the International Action Center from New York, and staff writer at Executive Intelligence Review, Daniel Platt, joining us from Los Angeles. Thank you for contributing to the program, and also a special thanks to you, our viewers, for staying with us on tonight's Spotlight. It's good night for now. We'll see you next time.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details. And now we enlighten you with Ayah 35 to 37 of Surah Ali Imran, recited by Shahriyar Parhizgar.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Dhurriyatan ba'dhuha min ba'din, wallahu samiyun 'alim. إذ قالت امرأة عمران رب إني نذرت لك ما في بطني محررا فتقبل مني إنك أنت السميع العليم فلما وضعتها قالت رب إني وضعتها أنثى والله أعلم بما وضعت وليس الذكر كالأنثى وإني سميتها مريم وإني أعيذها بك وذريتها من الشيطان الرجيم فتقبلها ربها بقبول حسن وأنبتها نباتا حسنا وكفلها زكريا كلما دخل عليها زكريا المحراب وجد عندها رزقا قال يا مريم أنى لك هذا قالت هو من عند الله إن الله يرزق من يشاء بغير حساب.
In the name of Allah, the All Compassionate, the All Merciful. When the wife of Imran said, My Lord, dedicate to you what is in my belly in consecration, accept it from me. Indeed, you are the All-Hearing, the All-Knowing. And when she bore her, she said, My Lord, I have borne a female child, and Allah knew better what she had borne. And the female is not like the male. I've named it Mary, and I commend her and her offspring to your care against evil of the outcast Satan. Thereupon her Lord accepted her with a gracious acceptance and made her grow up in a worthy fashion, and he charged Zechariah with her care. Whenever Zechariah visited her in the sanctuary, he would find provision with her. He said, O Mary, from where does this come for you? She said, It comes from Allah. Allah provides whomever He wishes without any reckoning.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
The headlines this hour. Israel launches fresh airstrikes on Syria, targeting areas west of the capital Damascus. No reports of casualties yet. Israelis have once again taken to the streets in their thousands to protest the judicial overhaul plan by the cabinet of PM Netanyahu. Plus, the U.S. House of Representatives has passed a stopgap measure to avert a government shutdown hours before funding expired. Welcome to our studios here in the capital, Tehran. This is Benyus. Thanks for joining us. Israeli warplanes have reportedly attacked targets in the Syrian capital, Damascus. Explosions were heard in Damascus as media released images of Israeli warplanes flying overhead, with Syrian air defense operating to counter the attacks. Details are sketchy at this point, as there have been no official comments yet from Syrian authorities. This comes as the Israeli regime has, on numerous occasions, struck targets in Syria as Tel Aviv pushes ahead with its acts of aggression. Tens of thousands of Israelis are back on the streets for the 39th consecutive week to protest against the controversial judicial curbs by Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's extreme far-right cabinet. Protesters say that they will continue the rallies until they are able to repeal the legislation. Mass protests against the judicial overhaul have been ongoing since it was proposed back in January. The Israeli Supreme Court began hearing the first in a series of appeals linked to the plan in August. It set off an unprecedented domestic crisis, resulting in public unrest, labor strikes, and mutiny by some members of the military. Critics say the curbs remove vital checks on the far-right cabinet's powers. Palestinian resistance factions have organized a rally in the blockaded Gaza Strip, marking the 23rd anniversary of the Al-Aqsa Intifada. Also known as the Second Intifada, it was sparked by the desecration of the Islamic Holy Shrine by then-Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon. To Ashraf Shannon has more.
Palestinians in Gaza rallied on Saturday to mark the 23rd anniversary of the Second Palestinian Popular Uprising, which is also known as the Al-Aqsa Intifada. The Al-Aqsa Intifada was sparked by the desecration of the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound in the occupied Al-Quds in September 2000 by then-Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon and his bodyguards. Palestinians have been holding protests in the eastern part of the Gaza Strip for the last 3 weeks, aiming to draw international attention to the continued Israeli human rights violations in Al-Quds. Hamas movement has warned the Israeli regime against violations at Al-Aqsa Mosque.
23 years have passed since the beginning of the Al-Aqsa Intifada, and we continue to fight for our holy places. The Israeli enemy must not provoke the Palestinian people. The equation has not changed, and Palestine remains an Islamic land. Today we assert that we will fight for our rights, and we will use all the forms of resistance, including armed resistance, to liberate Al-Quds and all of our land.
Protesters held placards denouncing the Israeli regime's desecration of the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound. They also denounced the international and Arab silence on the unabated Israeli crimes in Al-Quds.
Intifada means that there is determination for Palestinians to face the Israeli aggression and colonialization and settlement and achieve Palestinian rights for self-determination and right of return.
In recent weeks, the Israeli forces have increased their presence near the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound, taking advantage of Jewish holidays.
The Intifada continues because of the ongoing Israeli aggression against Al-Quds and the Al-Aqsa Mosque. We call on the international community to exert real pressure on the occupying Israeli regime to stop its grave violations against the Palestinian people.
Observers say the Israeli regime and its regional and international backers are responsible for the escalation of violence in Al-Quds.
23 years on, Palestinians say they are determined to free Al-Quds and the Al-Aqsa Mosque, no matter what sacrifices are required. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
The U.S. government has avoided a federal shutdown after Congress agreed on a last-minute temporary funding deal. The 45-day resolution would keep the government funded until mid-November. The deal still leaves out aid to Ukraine requested by President Joe Biden. The White House official says the president is set to sign the measure into law, but expects Republicans to allow a quick separate vote on Ukraine aid. In recent weeks, numerous efforts to pass spending bills in the Republican-controlled House were thwarted by a faction of lawmakers who demanded significant cuts, including no more funding for Ukraine. The House Speaker Kevin McCarthy passed the measure with the help of Democratic votes and even saw a rebellion from fellow Republicans during votes to reach a deal. Colin Campbell joined us earlier from Washington, D.C. He says the main sticking point in passing a permanent spending bill is the issue over Ukraine aid.
Well, one of the major sticking points is Ukraine, although Republicans, especially the more extremist Republicans, are very upset over the amount of spending in general. But it seems to be only spending when it comes to U.S. households, not when it comes to corporate welfare or military spending. It seems to be those who collect government benefits for food or for housing or for medicine, some of those basic care packages that the U.S. government gives to those who are living below the threshold of poverty or who are in serious economic constraints. So could we be back in 45 days discussing all of this? That's a very likely possibility. But I know that Congress is, or at least many members of Congress, would rather avoid that situation.
China has slammed the U.S. as, quote, a true empire of lies, following a State Department report that accused Beijing of information manipulation. The Chinese Foreign Ministry said the report has disregarded facts. It added that the agencies of the U.S. State Department that produced the report were the source of false information and the command post of cognitive warfare. On Thursday, the State Department accused Beijing of manipulating global media through censorship, data harvesting, and covert purchases of foreign news outlets. It claimed that China has hit major setbacks when targeting democratic countries due to local media and civil society pushback. The report comes as Beijing accuses Western media of trying to portray a negative image of China. In France, the government continues to enforce controversial budget cuts via executive decree, and even as the West's economic woes continue to rage. People took to the streets around the country, demanding action on a long-running housing crisis, which has reached new proportions amid record inflation. Ramin Mazari reports from Paris.
In the past few presidential elections, the number one voter demand has been to address housing issues, which are suffered by one out of every four people in France. Many consider the European refugee crisis to be in its eighth year, adding to the national housing policy failure. The failure of Western sanctions on Russia has helped rent to explode over the last year by over 7%, or an entire monthly payment. Major demonstrations were held across the country to demand the government finally take action for adequate and stable shelter.
The government isn't proposing any solutions for these people with housing problems or who are completely homeless. These are people who work, who pay their taxes, and yet still find themselves on the streets. It's a big, big problem. But we don't expect anything from this government, given how they responded to the fair requests of the Yellow Vests.
Demonstrators demanded rent freezes and reductions, the taxing of real estate corporations and multiple homeowners, and the requisitioning of a record 3.2 million empty lodgings. However, historically, there have been few signs that the administration of Emmanuel Macron is interested in dialogue. The 2024 budget has just been released, but don't expect to see it debated in Parliament. President Macron has just used his usual executive decree to force through yet another austerity budget with billions in cuts to government services despite the record economic hardship.
Macron uses the 49.3 executive decree, so the people remain silent. People are scared, and that's now our biggest problem. This fear has led to inaction and political apathy, and that's even though I hear everyone around me relating how bad things are going for them and for society. I don't understand their inaction, but I do understand their fear of getting involved, given the massive repression and lack of democracy here.
Many say that housing is actually an issue which any committed government can fix in just a few years. By making laws which favor tenants and not rich landlords, by putting more taxes into building public housing, and by creating more shelters for those with emergency needs. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
As India's general election 2024 draws closer, anti-Muslim rhetoric is flaring up across the country, with a series of incidents reported in recent months. Battered with hate and history of communal clashes, the country's Muslim population has always been a soft target. Our New Delhi correspondent Munawar Zaman has more.
As India gears up to hold the world's largest electoral exercise due in February 2024, violence against Muslims and other minorities has flared up across the country. Reports say the ruling Bharatiya Janata Party, or BJP, and its affiliated groups are responsible for the escalating trend. Observers say the hate has reached even the parliament, which many describe as a temple of democracy.
This is something unusual in our country. The politics of hate has reached even schools, colleges, and universities. Few weeks ago, I was literally terrified when some people pulled my dress on the street outside college.
Violence against Muslims has prevailed since the partition in 1947. That's when the subcontinent was partitioned into two independent nation-states, Hindu-majority India and Muslim-majority Pakistan. But with the emergence of the ruling BJP in 2014, the situation has become far worse. Muslims have witnessed systematic repression against the community, including hate speeches, hate crimes and mob lynchings. A recent incident inside the Indian parliament sparked outrage when the BJP lawmaker hurled Islamophobic profanities while debating with a fellow Muslim lawmaker. In another horrific incident, a Muslim man was lynched in New Delhi for taking a banana at Hindu temple event.
I have a hard time selling vegetables on the streets now. A few months ago, I was harassed in a community with many saying we won't buy vegetables from a Muslim. They called me by inappropriate names.
Since last decade, India has seen a growing fear and panic among minorities, particularly Muslims. There is a growing mistrust on the ruling BJP and its policies towards Muslims. The ruling party of Prime Minister Narendra Modi, however, denies any allegation, saying India is a democracy and believes in equal rights for all. But critics argue that the real agenda is to promote Hindu supremacy in the country to garner votes and retain power.
With general elections few months away, anti-Muslim rhetoric is flaring up across the country. Minority communities are yet again becoming political tools for electoral gains. Experts say the ruling party is dividing voters on religious lines, which they say could lead to social discord in a country known as the world's largest democracy. Munawar Zaman, New Delhi.
Pakistan has been hit by deadly violence as the country celebrates the birth anniversary of Islam's Prophet Muhammad. Two religious gatherings were targeted with bomb attacks in the southern and northwestern provinces. Scores of people were killed and many others were wounded. Our correspondent Nasser Kazmi has this report from Islamabad.
There is no let-up in violence in Pakistan. This time, terrorists struck a gathering of people with a bomb attack in the Mastung district of southwestern Balochistan province when they were holding rallies to mark the birth anniversary of the Prophet Muhammad, the final messenger of God in Islam. Dozens of people lost their lives and many more sustained serious injuries. Shortly later, another attack on a mosque during Friday prayers also left five people dead and wounded many others.
Attacking innocent people in gatherings and mosques is strongly condemned, particularly on a day when the nation was celebrating the birth anniversary of its beloved Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, who is a symbol of peace. These are Kharijis who are killing innocent people in the name of Islam. The state will not tolerate them anymore.
Despite these deadly bombings, Pakistanis filled the streets with great religious zeal and fervor, paying tribute to their beloved prophet. Pakistanis say they gathered on the streets to also send a message to those who wanted to distort the image of Muslims. They stress that Islam is a religion of peace and its prophet a messenger of peace. The celebration of Prophet's birth anniversary holds great significance in the Islamic lunar calendar and is marked with joy and reverence. This commemoration often includes gathering on streets, mosques, and homes where believers recite Quranic verses and narrate the Prophet's life story.
The birth anniversary of the Prophet Muhammad not only serves as a religious celebration, but also as a cultural and social event that promotes unity and brotherhood among Muslims worldwide. Nasir Kazmi, Islamabad.
The fifth edition of the Mustafa Prize ceremony is underway in the central Iranian city of Isfahan. More than 100 Muslim scholars from various countries are participating in this year's event. The prize is a prestigious award in the realm of science and technology, dedicated to recognizing and promoting the achievements of top researchers and scientists.
Iran is hosting the fifth edition of the Mustafa Prize ceremony. The prestigious scientific event kicked off in the cultural capital of the Islamic world, Isfahan. High-profile scientists from 57 Islamic countries as well as Iranian officials are taking part in the opening ceremony on September 29th. The fifth edition of the Mustafa Prize, which is often referred to as the Muslim Nobel, has begun in the central city of Isfahan in Iran and will continue until October 4th. Over 100 scientists and researchers from all around the world have gathered here today. Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi officially inaugurated the fifth edition of the prestigious scientific award. Addressing the attendees, he noted that the difference between the Mustafa Award ceremony and other similar events is in its view of science.
The Mustafa Prize is awarded to the knowledge that has the two wings of science and faith, a science that has authenticity and seeks to create happiness and welfare of humanity and the new Islamic civilization.
Raisi also said the Mustafa Scientific Award has a great mission and therefore it should be recognized as a creative movement. The president added efforts should be made to further develop it. The Mustafa Prize is a top science and technology award granted to top researchers and scientists in the Islamic world. Adorned with the name of the Holy Prophet, peace be upon him, and due to the Holy Prophet's emphasis on learning and understanding science, the prize was dubbed Mustafa, which means the chosen one. Mustafa Prize was established in 2012 as one of the symbols of scientific excellence and has been held biennially since 2015, recognizing leading researchers and scientists of the Islamic world.
I'm honored that I am participating in such an excellent and high-level event of Mustafa Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam Foundation. I think the foundation is doing a great job. It serves a window of the science in the Islamic country to the world. It proved that there are great minds in the Islamic world that deserve to be recognized and to be supported.
And what's really happening here is, one is, of course, the award giving, which recognizes very well accomplished scientists. And this is an encouragement for other scientists to do excellent work, especially in the Muslim world, because we all know that there's so much of good technology innovation happening in the Muslim world.
The prize is awarded in the four categories of information and communication science and technology, life and medical science and technology, nanoscience and nanotechnology, and all other areas of science and technology. This award is not limited to only Muslim researchers and scientists. It also acknowledges non-Muslim scientists residing in Muslim countries. The Mustafa Prize serves as a beacon of inspiration for Muslim scientists across the globe. The Mustafa Prize is not merely an award. It is a celebration of the scientific spirit and a call to action for Muslim scientists to continue their pursuit of knowledge for the betterment of the mankind. Mahdi Abbasian, Isfahan.
And that does it for this edition of World News. Bye-bye for now.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
It guides us through life. It has taught us everything. We should learn and appreciate what it gives us.
واقعیت زندگی
and try to apply them to our daily lives.
چجوری ممکنه؟
How is it possible?
از راه قرآن.
By means of Quran.
این خوندن قرآن و تلاوت قرآن قدم اول است برادران من این قدم آخر نیست
Reading and recitation of the Quran is the first step brothers not the last one
هو الذی ارسل رسوله بالهدى ودین
It is he who has sent his apostle with the guidance and the religion of truth that he may make it prevail over all religions though the polytheists should be averse.
تلاوت قرآن با صوت خوش با آداب که شیوه خاصی دارد موسیقی خاصی دارد روش خاصی دارد
Recitation of the Quran in nice tones should be performed according to particular methods and tones. But it's not enough.
مشکل بزرگ مسلمانان دنیا دوری از قرآن.
Muslims' major problem is losing touch with the Quran. Quran.
کتاب الله.
supplication on Sundays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. In the name of Allah, from whom I hope for nothing but bounty, and from whom I fear nothing but justice. I rely only upon His word, and I cling only to His cord. In Thee I seek sanctuary, O possessor of pardon and good pleasure. From wrong and enmity, and from the changes of time, and the recurrence of sorrows, and from the striking of mishaps, and from the expiration of my term before preparation and readiness. From Thee I seek guidance to that wherein is righteousness and being set right. From Thee I seek help in that which is linked to success and favorable response. Thee I beseech for the garment of well-being and its completion, and for the covering of health and its permanence. I seek refuge in Thee, my Lord, from the goadings of the Satans. And I seek protection in Thy sovereignty from the injustice of the sovereigns. So accept my past prayers and fasting, and make my tomorrow and what is after better than my present hour and my today. And exalt me in my clan and my people, and protect me in my waking and my sleeping. For Thou art Allah, the best guardian, and Thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, I am quit before Thee on this day of mine and on all Sundays that follow it, of associating others with Thee and of heresy. And I devote my supplication sincerely to Thee, addressing myself to Thy response. And I observe the acts of obedience to You for the hope of Your rewards. So, bless Muhammad, the best of Thy creation, the summoner to Thy truth. Exalt me with Thy exaltation, which is never made to suffer loss. And protect me with Thy eye, which never sleeps. And seal my affair by cutting me off from everything but Thee and my life with forgiveness. Surely, Thou art the All-Forgiving, the All-Compassionate.
Unity Week, Muhammad, the brightest star of universe. Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, has merits which surpass every other person. The Almighty says in verse 56 of Surah Al-Ahzab of the Holy Quran, "Indeed, Allah and His agents bless the Prophet. O you who have faith, invoke blessings on him and invoke peace upon him in a worthy manner." For a very long time, the world was gripped in darkness and was led astray. There was no hope, so that the most luminous sun of God rose in Hejaz in the Arabian Peninsula. Muhammad, the last messenger of God, did his best throughout in his life to guide mankind in the best of ways. he was born in the city of Mecca. The Prophet brought the most perfect religion to mankind. He was the mercy unto the worlds, as God says in the Holy Quran. While Prophet Noah cursed his nation and asked God not to leave on earth any inhabitant from among the faithless, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, never cursed his ummah and used to plead to God, O Allah, have guide my people as they do not know. While the Almighty says about Prophet Abraham, thus did we show Abraham the dominions of the heavens and the earth, that he might be of those who possess certitude. Prophet Muhammad stepped in the dominions of the heavens on the night of Mi'raj, the night of ascension, to the extent that the Almighty says in verses 8 and 9 of Surah Najm in the Holy Quran, then he drew nearer and nearer until he was within two bows' length or even nearer. Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, is described in Ayah 128 of Surah Tawbah in the Holy Quran as kind and merciful to the faithful. In the same ayah, it is said that grievous to the Prophet is the distress of people. In Ayah 4 of Surah Qalam in the Holy Quran, God tells the Prophet, indeed you possess a great character. Although the seal of messengers was superior to all prophets and angels, he was always asked God to grant him the best merits and keep him far from evil characters. Prophet Muhammad is the greatest bounty that God has bestowed upon mankind. He is the choicest of God's servants and has illuminated the universe with his light. The Almighty says, on this bounty, in Ayah 164 of Surah Ali Imran, certainly Allah has favored the faithful when he raised up among them an apostle from among themselves to recite to them his signs and to purify them and to teach them the book and wisdom, while earlier they had indeed been in manifest error. We should not forget that it was through Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, where the Holy Quran was sent down to mankind as the last and most perfect code of life and the best program for this world and a blissful life in the hereafter. Had there not been the Prophet, the divine instructions and sciences would not have been revealed to mankind. The Prophet was given the mission to convey the reality of monotheism to all human beings. The Prophet of Islam was a great servant of God. The Almighty says in Ayah 56 of Surah Al-Ahzab in the Holy Quran, indeed, Allah and his angels bless the Prophet. O you who have faith, invoke blessings on him and invoke peace upon him in a worthy manner. He is so lofty and sublime that God commands all the faithful to greet him and invoke peace upon him in line with the angels and the whole creation. It has been narrated from Imam Ja'far Sadiq, peace be upon him, that when a faithful invokes salawat, or a special form of greeting and blessing the Prophet and his progeny, the entire creation greets the faithful. Salawat means asking God to engulf the Prophet in his mercy. This indeed will be reflected to the invoker, as the Prophet is the mercy unto the entire creation. Therefore, if we want growth and perfection, we should obey the Prophet and his infallible progeny, the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them. we should be absolutely submissive to them. For sure, Satan and his forces and satanic souls among humans are angry at spreading of the prophet's behavior and even his name in the world. Hence, they resort to sacrilegious methods to tarnish the image of this luminous sun. One day, they draw cartoons to insult the holy prophet. Another day, they crazily burn copies of the Holy Quran. Yet all of these attempts will be useless as the prophet's fourth infallible successor. Imam Zainul Abidin, or Imam Sajjad, peace be upon him, says in one of his supplications, "Praise belongs to God, who has made our enemies from among the imbeciles." Yes, after any bout of insulting the prophet and his heavenly scripture, the noble Quran, groups of people, especially youth, are inclined to know Islam and its unmatched prophet. This leads ultimately to the growth of Islam in the West.
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. IRIB English Radio. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en.
Hello everyone, and welcome back to another episode of The Subcontinent.
The Subcontinent.
Everyone, and welcome to another episode of The Subcontinent, a weekly show that aims to address the most significant issues in the South Asian region. And in today's episode, we'll be discussing two major issues: the ever-growing problem that Pakistan has been grappling for 70 years, and also the growing ties between two rising economies. So stay tuned.
In this special episode of The Subcontinent, we will discuss foreign aid and a bane for Pakistan. And we shall also take a look at growing ties between Iran and India.
Pakistan has been seeking external financial help for a long time. Since almost 70 years, the country has been receiving loans from the world organizations like the IMF and the World Bank. Presently, Pakistan's debt stock is over $125 billion. This huge amount has brought the South Asian Muslim country to the brink of default. The faulty economic policies that Pakistan has been implementing to secure loans have increased the economic burden on the people by turning Pakistan into a dependent economy.
The Western countries, especially the U.S., have been using the carrot and stick diplomacy to aggressively advance their geopolitical interests. America's War on Terror provides a classical example where the U.S. used the grant given to Pakistan to fulfill its own vested interests in the region, in turn damaging the country. The U.S. being one of the largest contributors of international financial institutions like the World Bank and the IMF enables it to exert immense influence over the lending policies of these organizations. Western countries have been giving grants to Pakistan to fulfill their own gains, never taking into consideration the interests of the country or its people. The policies and adjustments that Islamabad has been making over the years to be granted loans by the IMF or the World Bank has only helped to fulfill the individual interests of the elite of the country. According to economic analyst, Islamabad needs to understand that the manipulative external financial help reduces entrepreneurship opportunities, makes the country dependent on imports, discourages the economic growth, thus preventing Pakistan to become self-sufficient.
Countries like the U.S. have been using manipulative financial traps to influence developing countries like Pakistan in order to fulfill their personal interests. Being a victim of debt diplomacy, presently, Pakistan is struggling to keep its economy afloat. Islamabad has been going to the IMF for years to support its balance of payment difficulties. Instead of boosting it, the foreign aid has deteriorated the country's economy. The policies of the IMF, which have been designed for Western economies, have had counter effect on Pakistan, which is struggling with huge financial crisis.
U.S. is the primary financial contributor to the organizations like the IMF and the World Bank, thus influencing its major policy decisions. The neoliberal economic model suggested by the IMF for the developing countries, which have a different economic infrastructure as compared to the Western countries, is damaging these states. These faulty neoliberal policies of the IMF are leading the countries like Pakistan towards a disaster. Tight monetary policy, tight fiscal policy, market-based exchange rate, and increase in utility prices are damaging the already fragile economy of Pakistan. Increased interest rates increase the lending from the banks, which in turn increases the capital costs, discouraging investments, slowing down economic growth, creating unemployment, therefore dragging the country towards poverty. Slow economic growth decreases the tax collection, and tight monetary policies lead to increase in interest rates, thus increasing inflation. According to the IMF reviews of Pakistan's economy, the organization has called for exchange rates to be market-based. Research has shown that market-based exchange rates have caused devaluation of the currency, increasing public debt without borrowing a single dollar. Instead of getting stabilized through the neoliberal economic measures suggested by the IMF, Pakistan's economy has not only gotten worse, but also deindustrialized.
Now, to have more insight on this, we are joined by political analyst, broadcast journalist, producer and TV radio presenter, Mr. Muneeb Hamid from Islamabad. First of all, welcome to the program, sir. Now, Mr. Hamid, providing financial help to a country is not an act of philanthropy. It's done to meet the lending country's own interests. So how has Pakistan become a victim of this external financial help?
Well, of course, it is not an act of philanthropy. The world understands this. And once anyone is lending money to a country or even an individual, so I'm sure they try to make sure to push their conditions, to push their policies, to push their interests the first hand on those countries. And this is what we have been seeing, what is happening with Pakistan in the past and even in the present right now, because Pakistan looks for loans from the US and other institutions for its survival economically, because we're weak. And this is how they dictate us on their terms, and they want us to implement their policies, to follow their policies. So, of course, this is another way of trapping Pakistan and other major economies around the world to follow stick.
So, Mr. Hamid, the U.S. has been using the carrot and stick policy while lending aid to Pakistan. The war on terror is an example. Apart from weakening the country economically, what impact has it had on the national and international policies of Pakistan?
negative impacts, completely negative impacts. We've seen Pakistan had nothing to do with the war on terror, but somehow Pakistan was engaged. Pakistan was dragged in this war on terror by the US, and we saw Pakistan, you know, see its devastating results, which we are still going through a lot of terrorism in Pakistan and across the borders. And this is one thing that has happened with Pakistan, and in which Pakistan was dragged. Pakistan had nothing to do with it, but eventually Pakistan was dragged in this war on terror, and Pakistan was weakened economically. Pakistan was provided funds. Pakistan was provided aid. And in the same way, as I answered before, this is all done just to make Pakistan weak economically, so that Pakistan can ask for loans, and then in return, when Pakistan seeks loans, so the US can implement its policies, the US can push on its demands, the US can continuously ask for do more. So of course it's had negative impacts throughout so far. Even still, we're facing the negative impacts.
Mr. Hamid, as you were talking about loans, the IMF and the World Bank have put conditions of adopting the neoliberal economic policies for availing the loans. So are these policies feasible for a South Asian country like Pakistan, which is struggling financially?
Absolutely not. These policies are not practically possible for a country like Pakistan, but for any, I don't see these policies reaping good fruit for any country in the world, because these policies are tailor made to support the elite. And what about the poor people of Pakistan and the people around the world? So these policies are not supportive of the masses, but only accountable segment of the society, the elite, the industrialists, people who are running big businesses, corporations. These policies are only going to support them. So this is the result. We see the rich getting richer and the poor getting poorer, and so poorer that they eventually end up, you know, in the graves. So these policies are not active, and these policies are designed to disband, to divide the society, and it has negative implications all out. So these policies are not practically suitable for Pakistan, for any other economy.
Ms. Hamid, you've mentioned this in the second question. This debt trap diplomacy has been used by the West in a way to make it difficult for the borrowing country to escape. So do you see Pakistan coming out of this debt cycle in the near future?
Well, honestly speaking, I don't see Pakistan coming out of this, economic death trap that we have been dragged into. There are plenty of reasons, just by controlling the dollar, the U.S. can manipulate and destroy economies around the world. And of course, when Pakistan is a debt economy, Pakistan's economy is based upon loans. So if we do not receive loans, it's going to be pretty hard. It's going to be pretty impossible for us to run our government affairs and, you know, run the system without those funds. So of course, we are in a trap. And I don't really have hope from my politicians or this existing current system that it is, in any way, is going to economically, become independent. And unless our governments or our system or the stakeholders in Pakistan don't think of creating a system sustainable for self-growth, for self-industrialization in all the sectors, I don't see Pakistan coming out of this death trap. For Pakistan to come out of this death trap, It is not very difficult. Pakistan has, alhamdulillah, Pakistan has all the resources in the world right now in Pakistan. But the people of Pakistan need someone to trust on. Pakistan needs a new system. And without that, I don't see us coming out of this death trap. Is it possible for Pakistan to come out of this death trap? Yes. But for that, Pakistan needs to make immediate emergency measures and maybe reforms. Pakistan needs a lot of stuff to do. And that way, Pakistan can come out. But I don't see that happening any soon.
On that note, I would like to thank political analyst, broadcast journalist, producer and TV radio presenter, Mr. Muneeb Hamid from Islamabad. Thank you for being on the program, sir. Now let's see what people have to say on social media.
Andy Anitizen tweeted, "Don't forget that foreign aid is a cover for enriching political allies and not what it's presented as. That is gender studies in Pakistan." Muhammad Farooq Qadri, a social media influencer from Punjab, Pakistan, tweeted, "Pakistan needs to develop its own indigenous economy and technology, rather than relying on foreign aid and investment. Pakistan has a strategic location and can play a key role in the geopolitical and economic affairs of the region." Sunia Khalid, a netizen from Pakistan, tweeted, "They are proven hypocrites on foreign aid and agenda. Pakistanis don't need them. We are here for each other and Allah is sufficient for us."
As the world is witnessing a shift in geopolitical dynamics, India and Iran have embarked on a journey to strengthen their economic collaboration. Despite fluctuations in bilateral trade over the past decade, the two countries are now determined to deepen their economic integration and foster stronger ties. With the operationalization of the International North-South Transport Corridor, the exploration of energy cooperation and the revitalization of key infrastructure projects such as the Chabahar port, new opportunities are unfolding between Iran and India.
Tehran, in line with its Look East roadmap, is increasingly prioritizing the enhancement of ties with India. India's membership in the BRICS bloc and the Shanghai Cooperation Organization holds great significance for Iran. These multilateral organizations provide a platform for trade, investment, and security cooperation, aligning with Tehran's broader vision of advancing a multipolar world. India and Iran view each other as partners with shared interests in transit, energy, and commerce. Tehran and New Delhi are actively engaged in the development of the International North-South Transport Corridor, an extensive network encompassing sea, rail, and road routes. Spanning over 7,200 kilometers, this corridor connects Mumbai in India to northern Europe, passing through Iran, Azerbaijan, and Russia. At the heart of this strategic initiative lies the Chabahar port in southern Iran. The port assumes a pivotal role in aligning India's interests with Iran. Serving as a gateway to Central Asia and potentially Europe, the strategic port provides India with access to markets in Russia, Central Asia, and beyond. India had invested $85 million in the port's infrastructure, and despite the hurdles posed by the U.S. sanctions, the progress on the project continues.
As the dynamics of the global order continue to evolve, the strengthening trade relations between India and Iran mark a significant milestone. While both countries have experienced hiccups in their bilateral trade in the past few years, a new era of cooperation is dawning with non-oil trade and the rupee-rial payment mechanism taking its center stage. With India and Iran forging ahead with their efforts to deepen economic collaboration, the diversity in trade between the two countries is opening a new avenue of partnership.
According to statistics, Iran's total non-oil exports in the months of April and May amounted to an impressive 21 million tons, valued at $7.513 billion. Imports during the same period reached 4.732 million tons, worth $7.941 billion. Notably, India has emerged as one of Iran's top five export markets, marking a significant milestone in their economic relations. In their pursuit of enhanced economic collaboration, India and Iran have also been actively working on establishing a robust rupee-rial payment mechanism, hence reducing the reliance on traditional international currencies, mainly the dollar. While rice and tea remain India's main exports to Iran, New Delhi imports an array of goods, including nuts, ammonia, apples, pears, pistachios, dates, and almonds, among others. Additionally, India has also been importing products such as methanol, toluene, crude oil, liquefied butane, propane, and mineral-based oil from Iran.
beyond trade, both the countries have demonstrated their commitment towards strengthening the bilateral ties through recent high-profile visits and talks. Indian National Security Advisor Ajit Doval's recent meeting with President Ebrahim Raisi and many high-ranking officials indicate the determination to elevate their relations to a new level. The shared vision of a multipolar world order as embraced by Tehran aligns with New Delhi's strategic interests, providing further impetus to the relations between the two countries.
You're listening to The Subcontinent, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. This weekly program reviews ongoing developments in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. Listen to The Subcontinent here on IRIB English Radio.
Now, to have more insight on this, we are joined by Associate Fellow and the West Asia Center Political Analyst, Dr. Deepika Saraswat from New Delhi. First of all, welcome to the program, Miss. Now, let's begin with one of the most important obstacles. Given the U.S. sanctions on Iran, how can India navigate the economic challenges and also ensure the progress of projects like the Chabahar port, which has already faced a long delay?
In my opinion, the story of Chabahar port has to be seen as a story of resilience. And I say so because since the signing of Chabahar agreement in 2016, there have been several changes. First, we saw return of sanctions on Iran, which made procurement of very necessary equipment tremendously difficult. I mean, in 2020, it was for the first time that, you know, when India ports global, got the responsibility for operating the port, the sourcing of the equipment became tremendously difficult. I mean, the tender had to be floated several times before the equipment, the mobile harbor cranes, were sourced in 2021. And these challenges continue to persist. I mean, so sanctions on Iran is one, and then the changes in Afghanistan. Afghanistan was very much part of the trilateral agreement, and now with Taliban Taliban in power, and I think that also adds another dimension of challenge to Chabahar port. But still, India has been using the port to supply humanitarian assistance to the people of Afghanistan. So I would say that it's important that we look at this port, which is being jointly developed by India and Iran, in a more realistic way, and see and appreciate the concerted efforts that the two sides have made. I mean, in the last 1 year, India has made very concerted efforts in engaging Central Asian countries to use the Chabahar port. So I would say it's important to see Chabahar port as a story of resilience.
Dr. Saraswat, in the context of India's membership in the BRICS and also the SCO, to what extent can these multilateral organizations serve as catalysts for further strengthening the economic ties between India and Iran?
You know, India has been, for over a decade, I think, has been advocating for reforming international institutions, the financial, the banking, this Western-led international institutions, and most importantly, the UN. I mean, India has been one of the key votaries of reforming, UN Security Council and staking a membership claim. So India, therefore, has been a very important player in BRICS and as well as SCO. It became a permanent member six years ago. So, which means these institutions, BRICS and SCO, as non-Western multilateral institutions, India has been a very, a strong voice there. So now, after many decades that Iran was also pushing for membership in these institutions, and now we see that it's happening. So I do assess that you know, these the expansion of membership in these institutions does reflect the you know, wider geopolitical changes that have happened and the increasing importance of non-Western actors, and how you know, that can make a more democratic sort of international order. And that means they that the countries are increasingly you know, capable of you know, having independent approach to issues. So I think overall it will be beneficial for relations between, you know, independent countries like Iran and India.
Dr. Saraswat, we've mentioned the Chabahar port. Let's talk about the international north-south transit corridor. What are the key infrastructural and logistical challenges that need to be addressed to ensure the seamless operation of the INSTC? And also, how can both countries collaborate to overcome these hurdles?
You know, corridors like INSTC, they are led by the governments of these majorly three countries, Russia, Iran, and India, which means to say that these states see developing of this, you know, transcontinental corridor of this scale as key to further more economic ties, more commercial ties involving private players, and which is important for the success of, you know, a corridor like this. So there are two things that I think have to be done, and I see there is more energy from all sides on those two fronts. First is to work on the physical infrastructure connectivity. And in this direction, the efforts that Russia and Iran especially have made for constructing the Rasht-Astara railway line, which remains, which has been a missing link for a very long time, that's very important. And the, you know, the more, what should I say? I mean, the work that Russia and Iran have done on the north-south railway corridor via, you know, Kazakhstan, Turkmenistan to Iran, and then that, that's another eastern part of the INSTC. That's very encouraging. But even bigger part is to make the private companies, the freight